Following is a conversation with a modern-day Charles Darwin, the biologist, herpetologist, adjunct professor of biological science at Florida State University, Dr. Bruce Means. Spoiler alert, during the expedition in which Means and writer-climber Mark Sinnott traveled to a virtual Shangri-La in the deep, mysterious, and ever-dangerous jungles of Guyana to study an unclimbed tipui, Means discovered five species that had previously never been known to science. Now that the spoiler is out of the way, this is the Happiness Quotient. Please subscribe wherever you're listening or watching, as this is on YouTube as well. Comment, like, and share with people you care about. If you want to find additional and exclusive material on this conversation, you can find me on Patreon at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient. Today I'll be adding an exclusive conversation with Mark Sinnott about his expedition with Bruce Means and their history together, having traveled five times previously to Guyana to study tipuis. Shangri-La has come to mean any remote, imaginary place where life approaches perfection. Few Shangri-Las remain on Earth, but one does exist that's been lost since 1595 when, on exploring Guyana for El Dorado, Sir Walter Raleigh said he saw a far-off mountain of crystal. Three centuries later, in 1912, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's novel The Lost World reawakened the world's imagination about a remote, ancient world protected by thousand-foot-high cliffs. In truth, that lost world and about 100 others like it really do exist. They are a series of ancient mesas called tipuis, all of which are remote, pristine, high-altitude Edens of perfection that are not imaginary. I just read to you from the introduction of a book that Bruce Means wrote called A Tipui, A Naturalist in Shangri-La. It has yet to be published. In March of 2021, Means traveled with an elite team of climbers, filmmakers, and naturalists to document new species in the richly biodiverse elements of a South American tipui. This expedition lit me up personally because for several years back in the early 2000s, I'd studied intently the possibility of launching my own search for Shangri-La in the nearby jungles of Suriname, to wage a first ascent of an unclimbed mountain there, which to this day I actually don't know if it has yet been discovered or reached. Our challenge was to make our way up a 5-mile-long series of cascades named after Dutch explorer Sir Walter Raleigh. We were told that there were more poisonous creatures than we could possibly count. Alas, the expedition never got off the ground, and now it lives purely in my mind as fantasy. My Shangri-La. Means and Sinnott's expedition to Guyana included filmmaker Renan Ozturk, as well as American rock climber Alex Honnold. Sinnott's article, Islands in the Sky, is essentially a deep dive, if you will, into the life and work of Bruce Means, a virtual modern-day Darwin. That article appears in the April 2022 issue of National Geographic. The National Geographic film is called The Last Tipui. I interviewed Bruce in June of 2021, but due to the nature of the information contained in the article and film, which premieres today on Disney Plus in celebration of Earth Day, I was asked to kindly hold off on sharing this conversation until publication and on the film's premiere. Means is no stranger to adventure and exploration. This was his 33rd expedition. Here's my conversation with the incredible and brilliant and passionate Dr. Bruce Means from his home in Florida.
This Tom?
This is. How are you, Bruce?
I'm good.
All right. Hey, there he is. All right.
There we go.
This is the white beard connection going on. this is fantastic. Thank you. So you're back from a big trip, and I don't know how that goes with you. If you just jump into the next one, or do you kind of rest for a while, or how's that?
Well, I wish I could jump into another one. That trip, you know, I turned 80 on that trip, and wow. Not many 80-year-olds can do such a vigorous trip. And as a matter of fact, it was quite strenuous for me. My intention was to get up to the base of the wall on this one wonderful tepui. We were attempting to do a transect from the lowlands to the highlands, to the summit of the tepui. But they radioed me and told me that the last leg, the last day's hike up a very steep slope with a lot of down trees, was something they didn't feel they wanted me to do.
Yeah.
Now, they had Alex Honnold on the trip, on the climb, so they did the climb, which was pretty spectacular. Originally, the idea was to try to help hoist me up at my age, and I'm not a climber, but and I would have done it. But the problem was I was pretty – my legs were in pretty bad shape. My knee joints were bad, and I was very unstable, and so a slip and a fall was very likely for me. Mm. I'm on a blood thinner, Xarelto, which has no, antidote. So had I broken a leg or an arm or anything, I could have bled out internally. And that would have influenced, you know, the whole expedition, because they would have had to try to find a way to haul my carcass out of there. And but the expedition was quite successful in the sense that the many days we spent hiking to get into the ultimate sites enabled me to complete an elevational transect of amphibians and reptiles I'd been working on for a number of years. So it turned out very successfully, but ironically, I'm still waiting for my specimens to be sent to me from Guyana. There's been all kinds of red tape hold up getting in. I had all the appropriate permits, but now it's tied up with FedEx. It doesn't want to ship preserved specimens.
And so what is included in those preserved specimens?
Well, just a few of them, not all of them. They were all preserved in ethanol to conserve the DNA. But about 20 of them, there were 165 in all, I preserved. They were large specimens, so I preserved them in formaldehyde. And then, of course, you know, I washed that off of them. They're still formaldehyde in them, and they're wrapped up in cloth and put in triple Ziploc bags. There's no liquid in the bags. They've been washed. So anyway, they just have a policy not to ship anything with formalin, and it was difficult to get them to break their rule for this, because even no matter what happened, even if the bags got ripped open somehow, you still wouldn't have had any kind of a problem. I mean, it wasn't like I had a bottle of formalin that if it burst, it would have really created havoc.
Yeah. So you're talking about frogs and amphibians.
Reptiles and amphibians. What's interesting in the tropics, or certainly in this part where I'm doing these elevational transects, finding snakes is extremely difficult. You know, we had 80 some porters on this expedition who were local Amerindians, and I paid them to find animals for me. And altogether in maybe 3 weeks, we got 6 snakes. So snakes is not, but frogs are extremely abundant at night. And so they're the most profitable group to do a biodiversity study with in terms of getting sufficient samples to do your work. Lizards are not very common as well. They're secretive. Turtles, of course, are almost non-existent except in fresh water. And so frogs is it in the Neotropics.
You know, it's fascinating to me because I almost feel as though I could have spent 2 weeks just prepping to talk to you, because the minute I opened up the first document you sent me, I thought, oh, this is just the beginning of this amazing wealth of knowledge and information. And then on the simpler side of things, it's like, no, we can go back to the recent trip to Guyana, and that will be my easy out. But I'm fascinated with your reference to Shangri-La, that these Tepuis are, that you call them kind of the modern day Shangri-La. And I think there might be some people who would hear this interview who don't know what a Tepui even is. And if you could kind of just on a general layman's term, explain what a Tepui is and then link it to that reference to Shangri-La, because that's really beautiful.
Yeah. Tepuis are very simply mesas. Mesas are mountains that are formed as a flat landscape rises and water begins to erode all around, leaving the pieces of the flat landscape isolated on buttes. You know, we have plenty of them out in the American West. But these in the area that I'm studying, Venezuela, Guyana, and Brazil, are the largest and most extensive tepuis in the world. Some rise to just around 10,000 feet. They're surrounded by vertical cliffs of anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 feet. The world's tallest waterfall, Angel Falls, drops 3,000 plus feet off of one of them. And they're really lost worlds. They're islands in the sky, I'm calling it. And Arthur Conan Doyle recognized their mystery by writing the novel, The Lost World, based on attempts that had been made by British exploratory teams around the turn of the 1800s to the 1900s. Many expeditions to climb Mount Roraima, which is the most famous of the Tepuis, failed until they finally found a way up. Now, myself and Mark Sinnott, who was the expedition's leader, have been in this particular area and also climbing Mount Roraima for a decade and a half. I participated as the biologist on other expeditions with Mark, having climbed Mount Roraima, doing a technical cliff climb up the cliff face, which wasn't possible to do back around the turn of the 1800 period. People didn't do technical climbs at that period. And because they are such remote, beautiful, wild places, they're also nutrient impoverished. So there was no reason for Amerindians to ever try to settle not only the summits, which were almost impossible to attain, but the surrounding lowlands and the slopes, because the sandy soils are just completely poor for growing anything. So it remained a biological remote, it's a biodiversity hotspot, because every time I go there and other people who do research in the region find animals and plants new to science just regularly. It's very rugged and remote. If you saw the film Avatar, you know, they had floating cliff islands. Well, those were modeled after, of course, the Tepuis don't float, but those phantasmagorical shapes with cliffs and the like were modeled after Tepuis, as was the little cartoon movie Up. As a matter of fact, the balloon went over and landed on a cartoon version of Mount Roraima. So it's got literary and modern artistic flavor. And I've been there. This was my 33rd expedition. And I have a book I've written about all of my explorations to try to give a narrative account for people to have a feeling for what it's like to be in that part of nature and finding all these wonderful organisms. And I was trying to think of the appropriate title for it. And then it dawned on me that I thought this region was a Shangri-La-like region. Shangri-La was the mythical city in somewhere, I guess, in Asia, that was the subject of a novel. But Shangri-La has come to mean a mystical, remote, wonderful, wild, paradisical sort of Eden-like place. And that's what I think these Tepuis are all about. The word Tepui is just an Amerindian word for mesa. So there's the answer to all those questions all in a big nutshell.
Wrapped up. So your book, has that been published, or is it it's about to be released?
I'm seeking a publisher. I certainly am. The title of it is Tapui, A Naturalist in Shangri-La.
Excellent. Excellent.
Wow.
It's done. I can't wait to find a publisher for it. This book is an antecedent to what I just did with the National Geographic Society's attempt to reestablish their Explorer documentary series. They're calling the documentary that I participated in The Last Tapui, and that's a reference to my last ascent of a Tapui, and the whole thing is about my work on Tapuis, and particularly trying to finish this elevational transect to a mountain next to Mount Roraima called Wayasapu. So, and then Mark Sennett has written a National Geographic article about it as well. So if I could get my book published and anyone wants to really read about the nitty gritty of all this kind of wonderful part of the world, it'd be great.
That's fantastic. You know, for years, I was unsuccessful in endeavoring to head into Suriname, and I had an expedition that I had been plotting and planning there, and it was to go up the, if you will, the major river. You're probably aware of Raleigh Fallen, right? That long kind of series of cascading waterfalls in Suriname that goes for 5 miles. And back then, an inflatable canoe was not as possible. So we had this three-piece canoe that we were going to take apart and you know, portage up into the jungle and go climb this mountain that at least at the time we believed had never been climbed before. But so I did a little bit of research and became fascinated with tapuis, although we weren't climbing a tapui that we were what we were after. But the one thing that really fascinated me is that there, at least I believe this is true, that there are species of animals, if you will, or amphibians or reptiles that have been isolated on the tops of tapuis and perhaps only exist on the tops of these tapuis. So somebody like Darwin or Humboldt would come across these things and be absolutely fascinated, like Galapagos Islands, but in the interior of the continent. Is that true?
Well, that's absolutely correct. And that's what I've been doing on all these expeditions. I have a tabletop coffee table book I'm also trying to produce, publish. It's called Islands in the Sky. Mm. And it's a photography book showing all of this. As you go up in elevation everywhere in the world, you know, different climatic zones change, and animals and plants are adapted to those various climatic zones. In the tropics, it's extremely dramatic. Even 1,000-foot rise in elevation can cause enough difference for organisms, plants, and animals to become adapted to the local nuances of climate and be different. But when you get on top of a summit of a tapui that's been isolated for maybe millions of years, then organisms living up there, you know, the summits are very harsh environments, because it rains and it mists all the time. Mm-hmm. And but the Achilles heel in the life cycles of organisms on tapuis is not when it rains, it's when the sun comes out. Huh. Because at tropical latitudes, at 8,000 or 9,000 feet, there's not nearly as much protection from the insolation, meaning infrared and ultraviolet light. So plants especially can dry out exceedingly quickly in just an hour or two of direct sunlight at 8,000 feet on the equator. Huh. So what are all the adaptations that plants have? Water loss mechanisms to try to keep water loss down. So the leaves are thick, or they're hairy, or they're tiny. Yeah. And it's almost a anachronism, I guess, you know, or it's a oxymoron, let's put it that way, that you get up on top of this rainy, wet place and you expect the plants and animals to be adapted for the moisture. And it's completely the opposite because of the severity of what happens when it does become sunny for a while.
Amazing.
You had asked me something.
The isolated genus or.
Well, the summit does have the summits of many of these tapuis. Do have an interesting little frog group called a tapui, a pebble toads. Mm. They're little toads that have got special hind feet that enable them to grasp and to climb. And what happens, and I've actually been involved helping BBC film this. It's very rocky on many tapui summits. And I mean, large boulders, house-sized boulders and cliffs and the like. So they climb up these rocks and these cliffs, and if a tarantula or a scorpion is after them, they just tuck up in their legs and they roll downhill. So we've filmed that. But the biodiversity is not on the summits. The biodiversity, you can reach summits now, you know, you can do technical climbs, but the most effective way is by helicopter. So many of the summits, not all, but there's about 100 of these tapuis, by the way. They've been reached by helicopter, and studies have been done on the summit by OTA. But where the real richness is on the talus slopes below the cliffs, which are exceedingly densely forested with what's called a cloud forest. Mm. So when you get down to 7,000, 6,000, 5,000, 4,000, that 4,000 foot elevational range where all these dense, beautiful forests are, man, that's where life abounds in great measure. One of the tapuis I've studied in Guyana, which is not even on maps, for goodness sakes, it's 34 kilometers long and 17 wide. It's huge.
Wow.
I've made 4 expeditions there, and every single time I go there, I find one or two species of all kinds of things new to science, animals. And I have one right now. I'm trying to write up a beautiful little frog that lives on this tapui. So it's, the tapuis are, it's quite obvious to me that they represent an unrecognized biodiversity hotspot of high importance on the planet, but their remoteness and the difficulty and expense of getting to where the biodiversity is, has kept us from understanding, from accumulating the data that say, well, instead of 25 species or 100 species, there's 2,000 species all around in the region, all at the base of all these tapuis. We don't know that yet, but hopefully it'll come to pass in the future if we don't blow each other off the planet.
Yeah, well, that's The thought is, like, there's, you know, and everybody brings themselves to this realm and they create in whatever way they create. And I guess it's all fine and well that people want to go populate Mars. But right here on this planet, there's a lot that we don't know and a lot that we could use here. And I'm not saying to exploit, I'm saying things that we could learn, just like from the tribes that live in the jungles who understand how a plant might, you know, help an illness or something like that. So it sounds like because everybody's like, it's all been done. There's Everest has been climbed, the poles have been reached, and the Mariana Trench was reached. But there's a lot left that we have no,
for certain, on all levels. Tapuis, let me give you some examples. Discoveries are usually made serendipitously. I mean, some guy sitting on the grass watching an apple fall came up with gravity. I mean, come on, you know, that's one of the great unifying forces of the whole universe. Or sitting and noticing that in a petri dish, a certain fungal organism kept bacteria away from it. I mean, that's what happens. Well, look, in these tapuis, we have dozens, if not hundreds, of animals and plants, all of which are relatively unknown to science. Many of them have wonderful special characteristics that could be valuable to man, although they're valuable in just in themselves to themselves. Look, every single living organism on this planet has one thing in common. There hasn't been a single break in the reproductive activity leading to that organism. And if you go back in time, genetics will show you you're related to every single living thing on the planet. So we've all gone through the same, including humans and our ancestors, the same trials and tribulations of evolution and threats to our existence as every other thing on the planet. So everything has value, but that doesn't mean that some organisms like predators like us can't take advantage of others, provided we don't take advantage of the others in such a way that we cause them to go extinct. Mm. Now, that's something humans grapple with and don't do such a great job with in some cases, or many cases. But anyway, all right. So what I'm trying to do is trying to tell you, I don't like the what's good for man hypothesis, but bottom line is it is. There are frogs down there that have skin secretions that I've discovered and noticed that they're very pungent to smell and they taste bitter. Those skin secretions could have a cure for cancer or a cure for, I don't know, skin disease of some sort, or who knows. So look, the whole human experience is the experience of cognition. The one gift we have is awareness, cognition, and all of that leads to building a scientific background. For look, what would we have done about COVID and other diseases if we had not had the scientific expertise to know how to fight it?
Yeah.
And where do you get that expertise? By knowledge you gain from nature. Mm-hmm. And so that justifies, in my opinion, any and all efforts to do research of any and all kinds all over the planet. And the planet's ripe for a lot more. We've just scratched the surface.
Right. Bruce, amazing. This is really fascinating. You know, this is kind of a jump off into another tangent. I don't mean to go down a rabbit hole or anything, but, you know, I've been kind of following some threads on social media of people going on Vancouver Island and logging, you know, ancient forests. And it's almost like there's competing forces going, like good versus evil. And I hate to simplify it, but I guess since we talked about Shangri-La in a way that maybe it's okay to invoke it, but it's like there are some people on this planet who look to just exploit nature for the hey, we're man, we were put on this planet and we'll eat all the animals and we'll chop the forest down if we need to. And then there's the other side who's aware, keenly aware of changes going on in the planet, you know, for jungles being, you know, decimated and burned down to make room for cows that become hamburgers at McDonald's, I guess. And it there's this balance. Where are we going? I mean, I know that you're not God, but are we going to be okay? Or
hell no, absolutely not. We've already passed many thresholds that we've shot ourselves in the foot. Look, oh my goodness, the greed that motivates people to utilize resources to their extinction. Look, we've wiped out so many marine environment animals and organisms. You know, that all is going to that is feeding back on us, for gosh sakes. You know, we pump so much CO2 in the air. If people would just watch the Keeling curve every day and realize how unbelievably scary it is that we are continually adding more and more CO2 to the atmosphere. And if you don't, all of that feeds back negatively on us, right? So look, let me tell you one thing. There's a whole lot of things one could be said in this arena, but the one that I, as a biologist, most like to think about. If you're interested in learning about nature or about, you know, what the real phenomena are and how they act or how nature operates, which includes us, you know, what's in the store for us. You need to have environments in which organisms evolved and to which they're best adapted in order to study those phenomena. You don't go out into a rice field and try to learn what the hell the biology is of some of the red-winged blackbirds that are eating the rice, because that's not their natural environment. That's just a little part of how they're trying to survive in the face of human activity. Yeah. So conservation, and especially conservation of native ecosystems where we can conserve them, is exceedingly important, because that's where the main knowledge exists about all of the organisms on the planet. And it also is where the phenomena of overpopulation and predation and disease and all that that affects other organisms is to be learned, because those same phenomena affect us. And they are affecting us right now. And, you know, as Americans, we're sitting in very nice and comfortable. Look at my, you know, I got books all over and you got a nice place. But you go around, every youngster in this country ought to have a whole summer off into a third world part of the world and live with a family that's grubbing for a living out of the ground, and realize, here's a good one. We're in the top 20 countries of the world by population alone. Not by density. Where does the United States stack? You know, the first thing is going to be China in terms of number of people. The second will be India. Where in the top 20 would the U.S. fit?
Down there, probably.
That's what I thought originally, too.
Yeah.
We're number three.
Really?
Number three. Really? 320 million people.
Yeah.
We're the third most populous country in the world. We're not the third densest. But the next most populous country, I think, is Indonesia. So, and it's like that. It's below 200 million, or right around 200 million.
Yeah.
Look, as we keep increasing and utilizing resources and causing, you know, old growth forests to be lost forever for the mighty dollar that somebody wants to generate from it, we're losing all of the important laboratories in which natural laboratories in which the knowledge about the world and about how we're going to be affected by what we're doing to the world lies and resides. And anyway, if we keep doing what we're doing,
well, if all of mankind were, you know, wiped from the planet, the Earth would probably be better off for it, right?
So, well, yeah, the Earth does restore itself, or it does have, we've had many extinctions, some really major extinctions, and following the extinction, there is an interesting phenomenon on this planet that life tends to proliferate and diversify in time until there's another extinction event. So the planet and the life on this planet are not going to go away no matter what we do to it. But we may well go away sooner than we think.
So Bruce, just to you know, I'm so appreciative of your time, and I'm fascinated by this, and I to be on an expedition with you, I can only imagine all the chatter at dinner and while you're trekking or walking through the muck and the mud and the rain. And but you know, say there's somebody considering going to college, a young person who's interested in what we just spoke of, what should they do? What would be a good, obviously following their you know, what kind of pulls them, you have to be your own unique self. But is there a course of education? Is there a field of study? And as you had said, everybody should go to, you know, live with a family in Colombia or Venezuela and eking off the land. So I guess you already told me. But educationally speaking, if somebody said, I want to be Bruce Means of the next generation, do they come and take your class at FSU or, you know?
Well, first and foremost, you should follow your passions. You should figure out what it is that interests you. I mean, you know, if you just want to become a biologist because there's some other neat ones around and it sounds neat to you, that's not the good reason. If you like birds or you like mushrooms or you're fascinated by bacteria, then pursue that and pursue it in every way you can educationally, because it can lead to a really satisfying life and a productive life that enables you to maybe add to the wealth of knowledge that human beings have created by, you know, the scientific method and being good observers and speaking only truth. It's, you know, biology is hugely variable. If I had a life to do over again, I'd try to just be a botanist and learn all about plants. But a good naturalist is somebody who takes in aspects of all of nature, geology, you know, mathematics helps learning, certainly anything and everything to do with genetics. And so you kind of have to write your own recipe, but pursue it wherever you go. And don't be afraid to like something like snakes, because they just can lead to understanding the same phenomena about how things operate on this planet as if you were studying funguses, or you were studying lichens on trees, or you're looking at fish in an aquatic environment. Mm-hmm. So that's my best recommendation. If you're interested and you're passionate about things that appeal to you, and not everything appeals to everybody, so it's whatever, don't let other people poo-poo you. I mean, look, when I was younger and I had an interest in snakes, you can imagine what kind of pressure I had on me. Snakes, well, I completed a 40-year study and just published it a couple of years ago on the Eastern Diamondback Rattlesnake. I studied with radio telemetry for that long period of time. So, and in that, I learned an awful lot that has useful application to human behavior, but I'm off looking at other creatures and just and having a great life.
Wonderful. Uh-huh. Wonderful. You were bitten by that one of those rattlesnakes, I guess.
Twice, different times, yeah.
And you lived, apparently. How did that feel? How did the snake fare, right?
Occupational hazard. You know, if you're going to work with something dangerous and deadly,
yeah,
and you're not careful over a long period of time, the likelihood of suffering the consequences is high. Yeah. And that happened to me, but fortunately I knew what to do. I had access to medical help, mm-hmm. and I survived it. And I have no, I would have done it. I'd do it all over again just because it interested me to, this was the largest rattlesnake, in the world. And, you know, Asia has the tiger, Africa has the lion. We got the Eastern Diamondback Rattlesnake. And
if you'd like a free downloadable PDF of the Happiness Quotients, A Course in Happiness, visit me at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, where you can also find exclusive content for patrons, including an interview with Mark Sinnott about his expeditions to Shangri-La with Bruce Means. For more information about me, to inquire about personal coaching or public speaking in person or virtually, please visit eyesopenproductions.com or join my mailing list, tom.dharma.pollard@gmail. Please subscribe and share this episode with anyone that might find these words inspiring. I rely on the kindness of my listeners to share with people that they care about. And while you're at it, click some stars and leave me a review. Remember, something very bright awaits us. Set one's mind straight and with good intent, even though the search can be deep. Something bright awaits us, even in the tragedy that is life. Thank you for visiting the Happiness Quotient. I will see you all real soon.